my favorite verses is from Psalm 45, I think it's verse 10. Be still and know that I am God. And the more we can become still and know that God is God and who I am because God is God, the closer to truth we come. And I think that's what prayer is all about, finding our own truth. Now, everybody is going to do it his own way. If you do it just like someone else does it, then we've got an imitation. And I have a hunch that probably is no one in this room who's here who isn't trying to get rid of anything that's dishonest within them. I mean, what we're here for is to really, you know, look for how do I live my life the best way I can live it. And so what we're really doing is working for honesty in our life. And how do we not spoil something that's, you know, ahead of us by just letting it be? I think before we talk about prayer, we have to talk about our basic assumptions. One of the first assumptions that we have are things about God. You know, who is God for us? And basic assumptions could also be defined as prejudices. They're something we just sort of have picked up from culture. We're usually not conscious of our basic assumptions. We operate on them. They allow us to exist and to act, but we don't really examine them most of the time. If then it wouldn't really be a basic assumption anymore. A prejudice is something that we hold before we have thought about it. Cardinal Newman makes a very nice little statement about faith when he said, any article of faith that's not examined is not an article of faith, but a prejudice. And so that some of our ideas about God are prejudices. They really aren't what we really hold about God once we start thinking. If you've ever read the little book, Your God is Too Small by Phillips, there you have just the neatest list of basic assumptions about God that are false or too limited. And that's one of the first things that a person needs to do if we really are going to be true. I am unique, you are unique. And if you think about, for those of you who are here, you know what I was trying to say with the little white stone, which comes from Revelations 2:17, that little statement about, I'll give you a new name on a white stone that no one knows but you. One of the things that, teachers particularly, parents do, society does, we're trying to lump people together. We try to describe people and put them through a kind of cookie cutter way of behaving. And prayer, if it's going to be prayer at all, has to be utterly, totally, completely unique. You cannot pray like anybody else prays, because then it's not you praying. It's you imitating the way someone else prays. Last night as I was praying about today, and I thought, if I could only say, make one statement that I think would be really important for you, I think it's that. You are unique. And Margaret made the comment when someone asked her what she thought the greatest insight she had in her anthropological studies, where she said that you are unique just like everyone else is unique. And that solves so many problems for us if we can just, you know, constantly hold that there. We have many, many similarities. Superficially, we're very alike. But if we really touch deep into ourselves and into each other, then we sense the uniqueness. And our responses have to be unique. So if there's one thing that you can, you've got to keep remembering, I can't do it like someone else. I have to do it my own way. If you're really going to be that unique imaging of God that he made you to be. There is a little 17th century classic that I found in the library, The Practice of the Presence of God by Brother Lawrence. And I'm going to read you a little section out of it just to point out this uniqueness. I marked your spots here. When Brother Lawrence was just beginning to learn constant communion with God, he often spent the appointed prayer time rejecting wandering thoughts and falling back into them. He just couldn't regulate his devotions as some do by certain methods. Nonetheless, he had given it a try. He forced meditation, but finally gave it up as a bad job. He has no explanation for this. What I'm pointing out is he tried it, and then just it didn't work for him, so he gave it up. And yet he was a person that no matter where he was very aware of the presence of God. When business diverted him a little from the thought of God, God sent a fresh remembrance of himself and so fired and excited Brother Lawrence that it was difficult for him to contain himself. But usually, Brother Lawrence said, he was more united to God during business activities than when he got along alone and got quiet for his devotions. I'm reading this to point out that he was one kind of personality. And because that's the kind of personality he was, that was his relationship with God. I'm going to pass out something, and I had asked Kay about this. If it's possible, if you people are interested, we might be able to get a Briggs-Myers test up here. Briggs and Briggs-Myers are mother and daughter psychologists, and the mother just couldn't understand how her daughter and son-in-law got along. They just shouldn't. It was a marriage that shouldn't work. And she was trying to figure out how can these two people get along? What is it that they have done that they can have such a nice relationship? And by the books, they just shouldn't be able to relate to each other. And as they were working this out together, they developed or understood, actually one of Jung's followers, a woman by the name of Toni Wolff, developed the notion of personality types. And Briggs-Myers are the two of them, are working off of that information. But on this little sheet that I have for you, you see different kinds of personality types and the way they're going to pray. Now, if Jung's insights, and I'm very new to Jung, I'm not, you know, I can't really say I'm totally convinced, but I'm very excited by the insights that I got just a few weeks ago from him. If he's right in his insights about, for instance, the balancing off, for instance, like you probably would guess, I'm an extrovert. Now, if a person is an extrovert, they're going to be an unbalanced person unless they can bring this weaker side also into play. And you sense this here as they're, in other words, if I'm just always fluttering around and being noisy, I am denying myself a wholeness. And so I have to learn to be quiet. The introverted type, if they're always going to sit in a quiet corner, are never going to be a whole person if they don't go out and meet people. And so that we have to come, you know, into a balancing with that. And the same thing is true in the ways we pray. But this would explain to you, and it would sort of explain Brother Lawrence too, why certain kinds of prayer are just never going to be quite comfortable. And others are going to be just the way, you know, you can just feel, this is right for me. That's another way of my saying we're unique. And this is kind of a psychological way of pointing that out. Something that's very interesting, most of the books on prayer that are more than 10 years old have not really taken into consideration psychological findings. There is a book by a gal by the name of Dorothy Phillips, and it's The Choice is Always Ours. And what she does is she takes passages from the classics on prayer and passages from psychiatrists and psychologists, and they're talking about the same reality. You are unique. I define prayer as how we allow ourselves to be in relationship with God. Now, if we're in relationship with God, it's a really true relationship with God, then we have to be in relationship to everything that God is related to. So that's others and all of creation. Part of our rape of the land comes because we were not really related to God. If we're going to allow ourselves to be in relationship to God, God is always, you know, present. It's just like in this room right now, if the mountains aren't in the way, if we had a good radio set, there are radio waves in here. We just need to allow those radio waves to be heard, and then we have to fine-tune. God is here. If we haven't tuned him in, it's the problem of the set. It's not the problem of the presence. Now, how do we fine-tune? One of the first things that's the easiest to fine-tune is our body. So that, for instance, our nutrition is part of fine-tuning. After you've eaten a Thanksgiving Day dinner, you are not going to sit down and pray well. If you read a book like Sugar Blues, you're going to wonder if you can, you know, really be a fine-tuned body if you're eating sugar to any amount. So that, you know, just what we do with our nutrition is going to fine-tune. What we do with exercise, what we do with rest, that's part of allowing ourselves to be in relationship with God. How do we fine-tune our mind? If we never think, then there's no way we're going to think about God. So we need to, you know, develop our intellects. We need to be thoughtful. We need to be searchers. And then how do we fine-tune emotions? We're not going to be able to use our emotions unless we become aware of them. And so that the whole notion of, you know, really reflecting upon moods and responses and reactions is all part of fine-tuning our emotions. There was a time when emotions were not good. You know, it's what you thought and what you chose and how you felt about it didn't make any difference. But that's not being human. And all we have to do is look at, for instance, the way Jesus responded to children or looked over the city of Jerusalem and wept or, you know, was really feeling bad. It was at the end and had a nice supper with his friends. And when it was really bad, took his three best friends with him. I mean, he had feelings. And he you know, they were there, and they were to be used and responded to, and so he invited them along. So we need to fine-tune our emotions. We have to fine-tune our choices. You know, what choices are we making? Do they allow, you know, us to be aware of God's presence? Or do our choices take us, you know, way into just frivolous nothings? And we can make those kind of choices. I mean, all of us have made them. So we need to fine-tune. Now, in prayer, they talk about the way of negation, the way of purification, and all of those words are, I mean, you know, they don't really vibe to us. But if we really stop and think the common sense of it, these ascetical practices put into, you know, our understanding make just the best sense in the world. Now, there are different kinds of prayers. Books are going to list them in different ways. One of my favorite is a prayer of quiet. It's called prayer of quiet. In the 14th century, it was called prayer of the heart. It's known as the Jesus prayer. Basil Pennington calls it centering prayer. But it's the prayer where you just are quiet, where you try to so fine-tune, you know, the presence of God and, you know, put things so still that the presence of God within can become conscious. You know, all of us are told over and over again, oh, you use only 2% or 5% of what God's given you. Psychologists look at human personality sort of like an iceberg, and they claim something like less than 10% of our iceberg that makes us is conscious. All the rest of it is in an unconscious, and with Jung it would be sort of also related to the collective unconscious. And part of that part that we aren't conscious of is the presence of God within. Don't you know that you're the temple of the Spirit and that the Spirit dwells within you? Or, now not I, but Christ lives in me. Or when Christ said in Acts, or Paul, you know, to Paul, Paul, Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me? And Stephen was the one who was being stoned. Or in Matthew, whatever you do to the least of these, you do to me. Christ is pointing out to us that somehow there is a presence of God within us, and that's part of that unconscious, and as we bring it to consciousness, the kind of consciousness, for instance, that Brother Lawrence had, where he just senses God all around, always, or, well, I think you could almost say always. It took him 15 years to get there, but, you know, that was part of it. Now, what happens in a prayer of quiet is we come to know ourselves. See, most of ourselves is we're not aware of. And that's why somebody can say, oh, they know you better than you know yourself. Because they become aware of something that you do that you're unconscious of. It's a way of, you know, keeping yourself in the presence of God. It's a way of being aware of reality. Prayer that doesn't really put us in tune with the real world, the incarnated world, isn't prayer. It may be a nice daydream, but it's not prayer, because it touches truth. It's rooted in our own inner truth. It's creative of our inner freedom, you know, where we're not pulled to and fro. There's a nice little definition of complacency as self-separation. If we're not a searcher or a seeker, then very likely we're just separating ourselves from ourselves, and we become a scattered person. Another kind of prayer is liturgy, worship, celebration, however we want to, you know, there are different forms of that, but a way of getting together in a very formal, public way. Something like we do with Vespers and with Eucharist. As a Benedictine, liturgy has always been a very important part of my life. I myself, I think I would describe myself as a person with a liturgical spirituality. So that, for instance, for about 6 or 7 years, I was getting to the point where Christmas bothered me. I loved the cookies, I loved the presents, I liked making things ahead of time, I loved the decorations, the Christmas carols were marvelous. But Christmas, somehow, there was a feeling of disjointness in me. There was getting to the point where one summer I was at summer school and I thought, I can't face Christmas again. I've got to find out, what does Christmas really mean to me? And I came across an article in a book I have, well, it was the article that's following, I think, this Theology of Symbol in Rahner's Theological Investigations, and it was just called Incarnation. I did not have time to read it, but I Xeroxed it thinking, well, maybe that's going to give me a way of responding to what Christmas really means. I'm pointing that out because I think one of the things that Protestants can learn from Catholics, some Catholics, is a sense of liturgy. It gives us a kind of rhythm in the whole year, and it's a marvelous thing. I know what it is meant to mean. It's just like I think what Catholics can learn from Protestants is listening to the Word. We haven't done that much, but we've celebrated liturgies. Another kind of prayer, which is really not mine at all, but I put it in here because just because it's not mine doesn't mean, you know, some of you it's going to be right there. Sometimes it's called imaginative prayer, where, and the way it's described, I have tried it, I've been with people, I've walked through it, but as I say, I'm not comfortable with it. It may be, someday I will be, I am not now, where you put yourself into a situation, you imagine, let's just say, Christ being with you at a certain time as a child, and going through a very hurting situation, but Christ really being there, and how did he respond with you there? And people like Agnes Sanford and, some of these beautiful faith healers use this, and it works. Jungian analysts use this going back in imagination and stepping people through for healing. And it's perfectly legitimate way of praying. And I think we need to take a second look at the notion of healing. I don't know, it's something I've been wanting to do, is go through the Gospels and find out how many times Jesus heals someone. And you know, in John 14:12, I think it is, where Jesus said, and even greater things than I you will do. Ask. So I don't think we want to just, you know, wipe out the notion. I know I did for a long, long time. I've just seen some nice things happen. I can only be an observer to this. Somehow it, but I respect it. Reverence it, maybe be a better word. So this imaginative prayer, walking people through, very often it's done for healing, very often it's done for insight. People will just take Jesus for a walk and imagine his presence and what he says and somehow talk to themselves, and he does marvelous things for them. Another kind of prayer is Lectio Divina. That happens to be a Benedictine term. Some people would call it Lectio, L-E-C-T-I-O. Divina, D-I-V-I-N-A. A spiritual reading. Now, usually Lectio Divina would be something that would be pertaining to scripture. However, very early in Benedictine tradition, almost contemporary with Benedict in 500, was the awareness that the humanities are also important to our understanding of who God is and who we are. And so, even a short story, well, let's just take what Dave did with the potter, is a kind of reading that was a spiritual reading. I mean, when we really reflected upon what happened to the potter, you know, somehow that led to prayer. And so Lectio Divina is a kind of reading that, well, tunes us in. That fine tuning is I think, a good analogy. On this paper that I just gave you, it comes, and I'm sorry I didn't write it down when I Xeroxed it. It comes from Anthony Bloom, who is a Russian Orthodox priest who spends about half of his time in Moscow and spends half of his time in Edinburgh. He has written 4 books, and I'm never quite sure of the titles because my first acquaintance with him was from a friend in England who sent me copies. And so they had English titles. And copyright laws, you can have the innards be exactly the same, but the title cannot be if it's published here in this country. And so that the titles get mixed up in my head. It's probably Beginning to Pray that this came out of. But if you look in a card catalog for, and that book does happen to be here in our library, Anthony Bloom is very, very simple. He did a set of interviews on BBC that became, you know, just very popular in England. I gave that to you because I have a hunch you'll never use the word mercy the same again. If you look at it, well, about halfway down the page, he talks about looking for the real meaning of the word mercy, and it continues on. Now, I don't know if we're going to have time to finish it, but I mean, you'll want to finish it, I'm sure. But that gives you an idea of what I mean by Lectio Divina, where you take a word or you take an idea, you explore what it means, and then it becomes something to you. If a word doesn't have a home inside of you, if you can't really say it so, you know, all sorts of nice little vibes happen with it, then it's a sound. I can remember spending about 2 years on the words of the Our Father. I read every book I could get my hands on in the Our Father, and then just sat with words. You know, what does our mean? And think of all the reasons of what you do with our. I mean, you know, what does our really mean? And you can spend a whole week working with the word our. Then when you say the Our Father, you know, after you've done that for about 2 years, you know, I mean, there are just all sorts of little lights come on, and that's just the first thing in the morning. Another kind of prayer is, well, I don't know that it's ever been given a name. I call it reflection, or maybe it's responsibility, divided as response hyphen ability. An ability to respond to what's around you. I'm going to read you just a little section from Brother Lawrence, where it tells what caused him to come to the Lord. His conversion took place in this way. In the winter, he saw a tree stripped of its leaves. He thought to himself, before long the leaves will return. Renewed, the tree will bear flowers and fruit too. God causes all of this. And that was the turning point in his life. Just seeing a tree that was bare in the wintertime. And responding to that bareness and the truth that he knew about what happens to seasons and trees. And it just blew his mind. Now, you know, there's just no way that psychologically we can process that kind of blowing of mind. But somewhere along the way, some little image is really going to trigger something inside of us. And I think we need to be very relaxed about it. When the right time comes, we'll respond if we're, you know, trying to fine-tune. I think we can feel guilty about not being Brother Lawrence or not being somebody else. But we aren't. We have our own timing. And our timing cannot be anybody else's. We might as well enjoy ourselves. You know, being frustrated with ourselves and anxious and all that does is toss static into the tuning. But that kind of response to things. Now, I respond to a white rock. You know, and all sorts of things happen with uniqueness for me with a white rock. All I have to do is see one on anywhere. And, you know, all sorts of lights turn on. And it happened one day, I was making a retreat for mothers. It was just before Mother's Day, a preparation for Mother's Day. And I was trying to think of what, you know, how do people become, you know, better mothers? What are some of the faults of mothers? And how can I make mothers feel good about themselves? And as I was walking out of our door, we had potted geraniums in sort of a big window box that was about 2.5 feet from the ground. And we had put in, I don't know how many bags of white stones. And I looked at those white stones, and I remembered Revelations 2:17. And I thought, if mothers would remember that each child is unique and she is unique, she can't do things the way any other mother does it, and neither can any of her kids do anything like anybody else does. And that's maybe the nicest thing that I can leave with the mothers. And about 6 or 7 years later, I visited a woman that I never met, and it was her sister who had made this retreat and had given her a white stone. It was on top of her sink in the kitchen, you know, at the kitchen window. So whenever she did dishes or used the water there, she saw that white stone, so she wouldn't compare herself to anyone else. And one of the biggest causes of our being uncomfortable with ourselves is we compare. And because I can't play the piano as well as someone else, or because I don't do this like someone else, then there, you know, I feel uncomfortable. But God never made me like anybody else. It's part of self-acceptance. And I think it would be kind of, I mean, it's fun sometimes to take a walk and just see what there might be along that walk that I can respond to. Sometimes nothing happens. I can remember once reading a book, and I wish I could remember. I was thinking about it yesterday and thought, oh, if I could only remember. But someone who was so struck by light on water, used to keep a pan of water just to watch the light on the water because of what happened to them. And I can't remember enough of the circumstances, but it's something like my white stone. So, you know, if we can each find our own bare tree or our stone or, you know, light on water or whatever it is, it makes our life richer. Another kind of prayer is friendship. William Johnson, and I wanted to check this in the library and I didn't have time, has a book called Silent Music, which is on prayer. And he has a beautiful chapter on friendship being a way of relating to God. And I think this is going to be particularly true for some kind of personalities. Something that's very nice for this kind of person particularly, and I would say for every person, is if you can have a prayer partner. If there is somebody that you can pray with and when I talk about journaling, prayer partners are very important there because it keeps us honest and it makes us do it when we don't feel like it. But I don't think that we should, you know, when you read some books, it sounds like nobody else is related in our relationship to God. And I know for myself, friendship has been one of the keenest ways that I have become aware of God's presence. And that's why when I saw it in that book, I thought, ah, this is me. This is fine. I'm okay. another way, and this, I guess I wish could become part of the way you spend a day, is what I call examination of consciousness. It used to be called examination of conscience, and the notion is, what sins did I commit? So when I go to confession, I have my nice little list, and then, you know, the priest will forgive me, and I never knew that God did it as soon as I was sorry for what I did. It took me a long time to find that out. But the first thing that a person does in this examination of consciousness is to really be aware of the presence of God. I personally use that phrase, be still and know that I am God. You can find your own. I mean, somewhere along the line, you're going to find something that's going to really spark. And whatever it is that makes you very aware, you know, fine-tunes you into the presence of God, whatever that happens to be. And as soon as you sense this, then, you know, somehow you sort of step back from yourself. There's, I'm sure all of you have had the feeling where you're looking at yourself and you're disconnected almost. You can see yourself outside of yourself almost, or you step back outside of yourself and you see yourself. And that happens when we become very aware of God and we watch ourselves responding, and with that we can kind of look at ourselves the way God would. Now, something that I've been doing for about 15 years is asking people to think, you know, examine themselves on some point. Look at themselves about something, maybe something that you did yesterday. And then on that same thing, what did Jesus see? Now, with the younger generation, I am finding that the two images are very often very much alike. 15 years ago, this wasn't true. And with older people, it's not true, because they're much harder on themselves. They see all sorts of things that Jesus would have never even bothered looking at. Somehow, I think we're not as hard on ourselves. We're not feeling as guilty about things, which I think is a much healthier thing, you know, amongst younger people, so that there's a more truthful way of looking at mistakes that we make. If we take a look at a two-year-old, well, no, somebody younger than that, learning to walk, you know, we let them fall. We don't like to see them fall. When the bump's hard, you know, it hurts. And if they really hurt themselves, well, we kiss the bump and blow it away, and it's fine. But by the time we're 6 or 7, we can't leave ourselves fall, get bumped, bruised, get up, and try it again. And by the time you're in junior high, you better not make any mistake. You know? We don't allow ourselves mistakes. Somehow, I don't know why we've gotten onto that. I haven't figured out why we can't allow ourselves the same kind of trial and error and patience of watching a little child. I mean, that's a response to watching a little child learning to walk. And what does it tell me in the way we respond to that little kid walking? I mean, we know he's got to fall a few times. I mean, there's no way. Well, I guess some children do. But usually, there's no way that that child is going to get up on its feet and, you know, trot off. It has to keep falling. And why do we think we can learn something without doing it that way? You know, all you have to do is listen to somebody learning how to play a violin. And, you know, with that, we allow that. But in making choices or making judgments or our own behaviors, we don't allow the squeaks. We don't want them to be, and it's bad or evil. And yet, I don't think that's the way Jesus looks at us. It's what I'm saying, you know, when you do make mistakes, you know, is it just tumbling? Or was it really a conscious choice that you made, that you really need, you know, to really reckon with hard? Or is it just something you brush yourself off with and keep going? That's something nice about Brother Lawrence. The book is so tiny that you can read it in 15 minutes. But when he did something well, so he did it, and so he won't do it again. And so he just went on. you know, that very matter-of-fact way of accepting something that, you know, we wish we had done just a little bit differently. So by putting ourselves, step one, in the presence of God, we put ourselves into a situation of hearing, of enlightenment. We maybe need to pray a little bit to listen so that we really, you know, pick up an insight. If we don't focus our minds a little bit, then we're not going to get anywhere. But are we really asking for the Lord to help us see through something? That's all part of that presencing of God in the way I do this. Then as we take a look at whatever we're looking at and asking enlightenment for, and what God has given us so that we've come to that point, the automatic response is thankfulness. It's gratitude. And you know, the word thank comes from an old Gaelic word that meant think. We cannot thank without thinking. I don't think we can ever be really grateful without thinking. And I think the person who is not, you know, really at heart core a grateful person can never be a happy person. Because if we don't have a sense of being gifted, if we really don't have a sense of being, gifted, then we're going to make demands. We're going to have expectations. We're going to just take it for granted. The child who just takes for granted that everything that he asked for Christmas is going to come is going to be very miserable when he doesn't get everything exactly the kind of thing that he wanted. The child who has learned to sense giftedness will be happy with what it gets. One family that I know, it's a beautiful, beautiful family. When the couple first got married, when it was before they got married, the first Christmas, as they were saving money for when they were going to get married, and then they were going to give each other Christmas presents with this money, and they were thinking about Christmas, and they were praying about Christmas, and they came to the conclusion that half of their Christmas money ought to be given to people who didn't have what they had. And they continue that, well, they're still doing it, so that what their Christmas budget is gets cut in half. Well, what do you do when you have, you know, like a 2-year-old or a 3-year-old? They don't have a budget. And so the way they've done it in their family, the little kids find out that mommy and daddy are giving away half of their Christmas budget. And then Christmas Day, the child makes a decision on which of its Christmas presents it's going to give to somebody. And Mary had given little Mary a beautiful doll. It was going to be one of these dolls, you know, that she was going to have to give to her daughter when she had a daughter. And so Christmas Day, when little Mary was looking at all her presents and just deciding which present she was going to give away, she gave away her big doll. And Mary said, oh, my heart just broke, because, you know, she had paid a minor fortune for the doll, and she'd envisioned this doll, you know, getting passed on through the family, and here it was given away, and she said, there's nothing I could do about it. But those children, I mean, you know, a child that can make that kind of a decision, you can sense the kind of freedom and inner freedom that it has in what it has. The child knew, you know, this was a gift. It's not mine. I don't have a right to it. There's just a different feeling. And those youngsters are, I mean, as I say, it's a beautiful, they have their problems, but it's a beautiful, beautiful family. And that's, you know, this sense of giftedness. If we don't come to that, we're never going to be happy. Because then we're always going to expect, I have expectations. Just, you know, like you sort of demand a nice day today. And if it's not a gift, then you can be really unhappy because it's not sunny. If it's a gift that we have sun, then the day is completely different. And if it's not sunny, well, it's not sunny. To examine, you know, my own sense of giftedness is, it's important. And the days when I feel kind of droopy at the heels, part of my night prayers are, why am I feeling kind of sad? And usually I can, you know, pinpoint it that I'm losing a sense of giftedness. I expected this to happen, I wanted it to happen, and it didn't come. And so I'm sort of pouty. Third step is, what's been happening inside of me? what's my inner world? You know, what's going on in my inner world? What are my moods? What are my feelings? What kind of urges? What kind of responses? What kind of actions and choices have come from this, you know, in my inner world? And I see what's happening in my inner world very often from my actions and my choices. But what we need to do as we look at these, and maybe I'll repeat those words, because if you want to work through them, you know, it's kind of nice to have them there. Moods, feelings, urges, responses, actions, choices. Now, I just jotted these down last night, and I don't know, you know, something will come to you. You have to make up your own list. You are unique, just like we are all unique. Now, as we take a look at a particular mood or a choice that we made or a response that we made to a person, then what we need to do, if we're really going to find out what's happening in our inner world, is what was the underlying attitude or what was the underlying cause for this? It can be that we had a bad night the night before or didn't get to bed on time and today was just a bad day all along. And if that's why I happen to feel, you know, really not very good now, okay, so go to bed early. If there is another kind of reason, then you've got some work to do. I'll give you an example. We were working on this, I can't think of the word, but this paper for the Archbishop that was supposed to be his affirmative action statement. So, you know, it was going to be kind of a learning experience for him. We'd have all these, and we could do it more often if we made it a, you know, like every meeting we sent him a little thing and then we put some little essay with it so that by the time we got to the end, he'd be, you know, focused the way we were focusing. And after our first outline, he sent a letter and it was very cryptic. Please call and make an appointment to consider the process that you have outlined. Call between such and such hours, Archbishop. And we could not figure out what it was. And we were really sort of panicky. There were 22 of us who were working in this committee, and there were about 5 of us who were meeting together after this letter. And we were trying to figure out, okay, now what do we do when we go to see the Archbishop? What is it that he's, you know, not wanting? And we were kind of panicky. We just didn't know. It was so, you know, funny. Come in. And some people were 40 miles away. So that to come in to meet on this, what seemed to be just, you know, common sense outline, really bothered us. One of these 5 that was meeting was a person that I really didn't know. And I was really attracted to her, a very sharp woman. And you could kind of feel in our first meeting, we were, there was a power play between the two of us. I mean, I became aware of this and I was trying to, you know, play with that. Well, as we were working this and we had all these sheets of paper on the floor thinking, well, if he says this to what we said, then these are our alternative actions, because we wanted to have all of our answers right there, that there was, you know, no loophole that we wouldn't cover. So we had these great big sheets of paper so we could all see them and the 5 of us at work. And then, you know, we just feel this, you know, anxiety building in the group. And I made some comment about, well, you know, we don't have to really worry when we get there because, you know, we've got good heads on the shoulders and we've prayed. And, you know, if we just go kind of by our instinct, we'll do the right thing. And this one made some comment about instinct can get you into terrible ways. And I really felt rebuffed. And as we walked out, one of the other people followed me and said, you know, I really think you were right in what you said. You know, if you just go on, you know, kind of a spontaneous response, you're going to be all right. And then I thought about it. And in my journal, I wrote that night, I really would like, you know, a relationship with Mitch. She really pushed me away. I think next time I meet, what I want to do is go to her and tell her why I said what I said. Because what I was trying to do is dissipate the anxiety in the group so we could be more creative. You know, if you're really anxious, you don't think straight. And I was going to tell that to her and her, you know, how I felt about what she said. And then as I was writing this out, I found out that really what I wanted was I wanted her to say she was wrong. I wanted her to apologize for the remark she made to me. And I really wasn't that interested in the relationship. But see, I was telling myself this at first, but as I wrote it through, you know, I realized, and then I thought to myself, okay, why right now is it so important for me to know I'm right? And then I thought of several things where people had disagreed with me, where I really thought I was right, and I was becoming very jittery about my own judgments. You know, am I really thinking straight, or am I really wacky? And so it was very important that this person that I was attracted to would agree with what I was saying, because of just my own, you know, inner, what? I guess my own inner, you know, self-worth. I had to have somebody tell me that I was thinking okay. And by her doing what she did, you know, it really gave that just another really hard bump. Now, when you pray through like this and work it through, you know, then you find out, well, what I wanted was an apology. And that's not really what I want. I mean, but are you seeing what I'm saying? When you can take some little incident that happened, and if you really pray before you start thinking this through, you know, you come up with an honesty. God's honest with us, and we really are honest with ourselves if we let ourselves be honest. You know, if we can put ourselves in a comfortable enough position, and you know, God does love us. I mean, so we can be honest. Another thing that we kind of take a look at in these moods, feelings, urges, is what important parts of our life are we shortchanging? That's important to take a look at once in a while. What am I doing that I'm really letting life pass me by? Then, the fourth step of this kind of thing. So it's the third step is this, what's happening in my inner world. The fourth step is, you know, as we look at this, we see hurts. You know, just take my example of, you know, where people have been really knocking me for ideas that I had, and I really felt the need. Then, you know, we do things. Now, I could have gone to Mitch and sort of, with my hidden agenda, tell her that I wanted an apology. No, I really didn't want that. I mean, you know, as I thought about it, that's not what I wanted. Which means that I need God to give me, well, to forgive me for my not trusting myself, not trusting that he's with me, being devious. I wasn't really honest with myself with my first thinking. And if I hadn't taken the time to think that through, maybe I would have gone to her, and you know what would have happened? It would have been just like this. And you know what would have happened on the committee? I mean, it would have taken a long time to work that thing through. We could have, there were 22 of us, and we were from about here to here on women's issues. And we came up with a document. We decided that it had to be unanimous before we started. And to work through in a year so that everybody could agree on what we said, so that when it went to the bishop, all of us owned it 100%, you know, was an undertaking. We couldn't come to an agreement on three things. I can't, not quite sure remember, but one of them was sexist language, couldn't get in there. And so the way we got around it was at the end of the document, we said, these three items, many people feel very strongly on, but we did not have a unanimous agreement, and therefore, these are these three things. One was, you know, looking into ordination of women, sexist language, and I forget what the third thing was. But if we don't, you know, work through that in honesty and ask God to forgive us, and forgiveness, I think, really, if you take a look at the rest of that word mercy, you know, somewhere in the next couple of days, it means God has to give us a new start and all the strength that comes with it. So the fourth part is to look at what really needs to be forgiven and ask for God's mercy on that. And as soon as we ask, it's ours. It comes in small dribbles because, you know, we don't tune in well enough. But then the fifth step is to plan a strategy for the next day so that you kind of, you know, follow things up. And like, for instance, for myself, taking this example that I gave you with Midge, I wanted to be really alert to how many times the next day I had to have people tell me I was right. because that was not something I really, you know, wanted to go around, you know, that it was my hidden agenda all day long to have somebody say, you know, Ruth, you're right. And we can do that, you know. When we're hurting in a certain way, we carry these hidden agendas. And as soon as we've got them, you know, what we're doing is pulling all sorts of fire screens around us. You know, the old-fashioned theaters where you had this one and this one, and depending upon how many hidden agendas we're carrying, you know, we've got that many curtains between us and the person we're trying to relate to. We do that with God, too. That's why it's so terribly important to really take a hard look at our basic assumptions about God and about ourselves. I'm not sure, and you know, Kay, I'm glad you're here, and Scott, and you. Am I right in saying that, according to Lutherans, the notion of man is that man is really so hurt by the fall that of himself he can do absolutely nothing? There is no good left in him. Is that a right notion?
That has been a very strong Lutheran teaching, but there's also been some movement. A part of that has been such a denial of potential of humanity that's kind of being looked at in a totally new way. And I think part of what happens in the liturgies and worship and stuff is beginning to emphasize the other side of that. We looked at, you know, old worm that I am, and now saying,
now see, that was my stereotype of what, you know, one way of looking at man. Now, if we really accept that notion, then there is absolutely nothing I can do to fine-tune. Now, if we look at man from the way the new look would be, man's wounded, but he can say help. And if he says help, then somebody says yes. But if I can only sit, then something else happens. So our basic assumption of who man is and where man is going to determine the way we live. If I think that the most wonderful thing that can happen is I can just not feel anything, then I'm going to live one way. So in planning our strategy or in examining our consciousness, we have to really take a hard look at what do we really think man is? You know, how much power do I really have? Now, I've come to some kind of interesting ideas here, and I'm not sure that I'm totally right, but I'm going to pass them on because right now they're exciting to me. I have the feeling that man is much greater than I thought, that God has given us much greater powers. I have a feeling that that's what Jesus meant when he said, this is the way you pray, our Father. Now, at the time of Jesus, there was such a pessimism in the Mediterranean world that the two leading rabbinical schools, one in Jerusalem and one up at Nablus in Samaria, I forget what Safat was what it was called in those days, spent 2 years trying to come to a conclusion on, was it better that a person was born or not? Would have been better if man hadn't been born. Now, you know, that's a pretty way of looking. But this is what Jesus came into. And, you know, from his point of view, how is he going to break that? How can he give a new look for people? How can he make people turn, you know, 180 degree turn on that? Now, if you take a hard look at all the possible images of God's relationship to us, you can't find a better one than Father. I tried. If God is our Father, it means we share his nature. I mean, that's what Father means. It means that we are given, if a father is really a father, trust. We're expected to become something like our father, you know, a certain maturity. We have certain capabilities. And so that man is really, I think, much greater than we've thought man to be. When I first came onto this idea, which is about 10 or 15 years ago, Michael Schmaus, who was the head of the theology department at Munich and retired at age 70, and decided that he was going to do two things that he had always wanted to do: learn English and live in the Orient. So he could read English, but you know, he wanted to speak English well. So he went to Japan to learn English and live in the Orient. And he spoke just like a German who learned English in Japan. Oh, it was, I mean, it took us, I don't know how long, just to, and some people would go back because his, you know, sentence structure was German. And the people who knew German very well would translate this Japanese-sounding English into German and then give it back to the rest of us into English. But he was a person who was just very, well, he wrote an 8-volume dogmatique that's, each volume is like this, and one of the most creative Catholic theologians. At this point, he'd be, what, 85 or maybe not alive. And I said to him, you know, when we're talking about image and likeness of God, what does that really mean? And he said, the image and likeness of God. I said, okay. He said, I would say man is what God is, excepting that God created him. That's kind of frightening. And I've been playing with that idea ever since. And I'm going to read something. Brother Lawrence's big thing is on love. You know, it's love of God. For me, it's truth. And the bell is ringing. One person wants me to go on. We can go on and the rest can go for lunch. I'm horrible about this. I know it. It happens to me all the time. I've never learned how to really watch a clock. I found this in the bookstore. I was all excited because I was going to mail Luther in St. Paul to send me a copy. They've got a marvelous bookstore that always gives you 20% off. Abraham Heschel was a Jew, died in 1972. He was one of the people who, for instance, was at Selma with people like Harvey Cox and those people. And he has in here, what he does is he takes a look at a Jewish person who was searching for truth. And in his search for truth, he, you know, takes him through the steps, and it's sort of a biographical book. And Heschel says here, in the Jew of our time, distress at God's predicament may be a more powerful witness than a tacit acceptance of evil as inevitable. The outcry of anguish certainly adds more to his glory than callousness or even flattery of God's pathos. Then he says, man's inability to understand the ways and acts of God is obviously due to an inherent inadequacy or privation in his nature, due to the banishment of truth from his life. So precisely, the incapacity of man to share God's truth is both the source and the object of pain. That wasn't what I wanted to read to you. Anyway, oh, it's on this side. I should have marked it. What Heschel says, that Kratzker said, was that man should never capitulate to God. And when we say, you know, we tune ourselves into God and we really stay there, you know, completely listening and trying to be enlightened, and then to say that we should never give in to God, we should never capitulate to God, we should, you know, hold on to our own uniqueness. And that's what this Kratzker did. He was kind of a Job figure. And I wanted to show that to you, you know, partly. Remember when I said, if there was one thing I could do for you, I hoped I could impress upon you your uniqueness. And to hold tight to your own uniqueness. Hold tight to the image of God that's within you. Job does this to, he does it marvelously. In the 8th chapter of Job, if you want to, 9th chapter of Job, if you want to take a look at the integrity of Job, remember at the time of this writing, whoever wrote Job, the Jews really believed that if evil befell you, you sinned. If you didn't sin, well, then somebody in your family did. That was just obvious. It was one of those basic assumptions of the time. If you were sick, then you sinned, or maybe your parents sinned. Remember the story where the apostles came upon the blind man and they said, did this man sin or was it his parents who sinned? And Jesus said, no one. It's that the glory of God may be revealed in him. But that was still a basic assumption at the time of Jesus. Remember the Pharisees, having wealth was God's blessing? And Job has already thought this through and doesn't think this anymore. And he says, truly I know that it is so, that a man is sinful and weak and all the rest. But how can a man be just before God? If one wished to contend with him, one could not answer him once in a thousand times. And then he goes on, and he says, though I am innocent, I cannot answer him. I must appeal to for mercy for my right. I'm picking up an alternative translation here. It says, I must appeal for mercy to my accuser, to somebody who's going to be a judge. And all through, Job would not admit that he had done anything evil. He, you know, his friends were really beating at him, and he wouldn't. And he goes on, and he says, you know, it's God that's wrong, I am not. Job would not capitulate to the theology of the time. He was totally himself. And then at the end, what happens, you know, after Job and God are with each other, then God tells his friends, who are telling him all the current Orthodox theology, now go and take seven bulls and seven rams and go to Job. This is in chapter 42 of Job. And offer up for yourselves a burnt offering, and my servant Job will pray for you. For I will accept his prayer, not to deal with you according to your folly. For you have not spoken of me what is right as my servant Job has. Even though in my uniqueness and in my need for people to say I'm right, I have to be right. I have to keep testing it out, you know, because I can have basic assumptions that are completely false. But once I am, you know, really before God, knowing I'm doing the right thing, then no matter what anybody else says, I have to be true to my own uniqueness. And I think that that's what happens. I mean, this is what, and God says, you know, Job was good for telling me, you know, you're not being fair to me. The last thing I wanted to do was talk about journal keeping, and I think we can say that very shortly. I have a hunch, well, I know Abbot David down at Pecos claims that the fidelity with which you keep your journal is the measure of your fidelity of your search for God. I don't know, I mean, if that's true, then I'm not very good, because I haven't written for about 2 weeks in my journal. But there, you know, I'll tell you what I do. I happen to have this kind of a notebook. Now, I took the notebook apart because my spiritual director is not here. And so I send my pages to my journal, and then I get responses back. See, it's kind of like your prayer partner or, you know, somebody who can take a look and say, oh, no, did you really mean that? You know what that's what you're writing there? So my notebook happens to be, you know, this way at this point, because I pull out all the spirals. Now, for instance, one of the things, and the way I did it, remember, I'm unique. I've decided to pinpoint the tensions that are keeping me tight. And then I go on and I write a whole list of tensions and I write some more. And you know, that's about 3 weeks work to, you know, go through those. But that's the, you know, kind of thing that I do. One of the things that I put into my journal are quotations from a book that I particularly like. And I'll put page numbers there, because very often if you liked it well enough to put it in here, you may want to share it with somebody, and you might want to write to them and say, oh, you know, I really like page 269. And you remember, you know, you take little snippets because you don't put everything there. That's something that I put in. Sometimes if something, and this you can tell comes out of a book, the way I have my things out of a book is because I put two things to a line, and what I write is separate, and then it's easy for me to find what I want. That really hit me. You know, I mean, everybody has to work out his own way. And this is a page of, actually, this was part of what would have been a strategy, and the red was my strategy. And so by having it red when I flipped through my pages, then, you know, it jumped out at me right away. Things that to put into your journal would be something about what happens to you in prayer. You know, what did you find out as you were praying? For instance, like this notion of, I really wanted to be right. What's happening in my relationships? What is my own self-awareness? At what level is my self-awareness? A very good thing to do is to dialogue with whatever's bothering you. Even like, for instance, if you've got a chronic backache, dialogue with your backache. Because, well, for instance, medicine today has found out that very often a backache comes because of some kind of, you know, inner turmoil that has nothing to do with the back itself. And as you dialogue with that backache, you all of a sudden may surface, because this is kind of a flow of consciousness, you surface the thing that's causing, you know, the inner tension that's causing the backache. So dialoguing in your journal is a very good thing to do. We didn't talk about dreams. Martin Kelsey has a very good two books, and one are very short, and I don't know if there's anything here in the library, but you know, if you take a hard look at the Old Testament, if you take a look, you know, Joseph was told something in a dream. The early church fathers all were conscious that God dealt with them in their dreams, because in the unconscious, where the presence of God is within us, there is an interplay. And when we're completely out, then that can work. And that can surface and operate in our consciousness. And so if we can take a hard look at our dreams, we find out what's going on inside. It's another way of tapping our inner world. One of the things that I did, you remember when I told you I was 30 years of Benedictine, and as I'm trying to put together pieces, this little sheet, I've been putting, you know, passing it along in my notebook. It's hard now that it's all in pieces, but one of the things that I did here was list what I wanted to take a hard look at as I revamp my life and try to figure out where God wants me to go. And so I made myself a whole list of questions here just to keep me aware that I wanted to be working with these. Sometimes I take one of those questions and work with it. One of the things that I did very interesting too, I was reading a book and I disagreed with a person who used the word responsibility, that God gives us, trust. God gives us trust to do, you know, his work here on earth. And I thought, no, God gives us responsibility. And then I thought, well, why did I disagree? Because it was Carol Hostetler, and she and I are just, she's been dead, I don't know how long, but an English writer. But when I read her, just, you know, everything inside of me just fits. And I thought, well, why am I disagreeing with her? And so I just worked with my ideas of trust and responsibility. And, you know, trust is so much nicer than responsibility. Responsibility, you've got this, it's checked on. Trust, and it's personal. You know, I mean, and I went back, found out why she said it. I mean, I put trust back in. I'd taken it out and put in responsibility. But those are the kinds of things you can work through in your journal. Now, this is amen to us. If you want to ask me questions, if you want me to help you start a journal, if you want to, for instance, walk through like some afternoon or some evening, and we would go through an examination of consciousness together. You know, like I could just do one out loud, and then you can, you know, come along with me. If there's any way I can help you, I have a hunch that's maybe why I'm here. You know, God puts his places for reasons. You know, if I can't, then I'll tell you. The one word that I'm kind of trying to work with for myself is truth. Am I really honest? And I hope I'm honest with you. And if I'm not, then, you know, you've got an obligation to tell me, because there's a reason why you're here, too. Lord Jesus, where two or three of us are gathered together in your name, you're with us. And as we spend the winter together, help us to understand your presence, to feel it, to know it, to have it confront the way we think, the way we act. Help us to be able to respond to each other and be your presence for each other.